Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is February 6th, 2018, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is I'm Wheezy Like a Preschooler, Prednisolone for Wheezy Children. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Tessa Davis. She's a pediatrician specialist in pediatric emergency medicine, currently practicing in central London. She's also the co-founder of this amazing FOMED website, Don't Forget the Bubbles. Welcome to the SGEM, Tessa.
Hi, thanks, Ken. Really great to be here.
Well, we're combining FOMED forces because you did this excellent review of the paper that we're going to be talking about today for your blog, Don't Forget the Bubbles.
Yeah, that's right. Damien Rowland, who is a Don't Forget the Bubbles teammate of mine, and me reviewed this paper because it's a great paper that's really got potential to be very important in pediatric practice.
And I already had it scheduled to be reviewed, I think. And then when I saw yours, I said, hey, let's combine FOMI forces. And this will be a bit of spaced repetition with some nerdiness added on top.
That's awesome. We love a bit of foam collaboration, so we're very pleased.
And I love talking nerdy. So I also need to give a shout out to Andy Tagg for suggesting the theme music, Easy Like Sunday Morning by Lionel Richie.
Yep, Andy's one of my Don't Forget the Bubbles co-founders as well, and he is great at coming up with creative suggestions, so I'm glad he was able to help you there.
All right, give us a case.
Okay, so our case is Tom. Tom is a four-year-old boy. He comes into your emergency department with a wheeze following a viral upper respiratory tract infection. He's been taking salbutamol at home today, but he's still not improving, so his parents brought him in. When you see him, he's got mild work of breathing and he's got bilateral wheeze. His oxygen sats are 94% on room air. Tom's otherwise well with no other previous medical history. So you start to write up a salbutamol. But should you give him a dose of prednisolone too?
We see a lot of little wheezers in the emergency department, in fact, all the time. And it's really common during the winter months, often due to viral infections.
Yeah, that's right. And we always have this debate back and forth between ourselves and our daily practice about whether we should be giving prednisolone to these viral wheezes in preschool children.
Well, in 2009, a study by Panicker et al. Found no positive effect in giving steroids to preschool children with wheeze.
Yeah, and we've seen that our practice and our treatment guidelines have gradually changed. So whereas 10 years ago, we were giving prednisolone to all of these preschoolers, over the years since Panicker, our guidelines have actually adopted this Panicker findings. And so we now no longer give prednisolone to preschool wheezers.
So what you're saying is we don't need to Panicker and give prednisolone.
Ah, I love a great pun.
What's the clinical question for today's podcast?
Our clinical question is, does oral prednisolone improve virus-associated wheeze in preschool-aged children?
And what's the reference?
This is a study by Foster et al., which is oral prednisolone in preschool children with virus-associated wheeze, a prospective, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, which was published in The Lancet just a couple of weeks ago.
And let's run through the PICO. What's the population?
The population is patients aged 24 to 72 months who have presented to their emergency department with a wheeze plus symptoms or signs of a viral upper respiratory tract infection.
And there were a number of exclusions, and I'll list them in the show notes. What was their specific intervention?
The intervention was a 3-day course of oral prednisolone, which was given at a dose of 1 milligram per kilogram once a day.
And what was their comparison?
The comparison was giving a placebo drug, and they matched it so that it looked, smelt, and tasted exactly like prednisolone.
In other words, yuck.
Yep.
All right, how about the outcome? What was the primary outcome?
The primary outcome was length of stay in the hospital.
And their secondary outcomes?
There was a few secondary outcomes. They looked at reattendance, readmission, salbutamol usage after discharge, and also residual symptoms after discharge.
And now, it is our pleasure to have the senior author. Now, that's not based on age, but in the order that the names appeared on the paper. So we've got Dr. Meredith Borland, and she is a pediatric emergency medicine specialist from Perth, Australia. And she's been doing clinical research for, let's just say, a while. And she's also the director of her own pediatric tertiary care emergency department. Welcome to the SGEM, Meredith.
Thank you very much.
Well, I got to tell you how great it was that we ran into each other recently at Ski Beam, which is this amazing conference, just this last month. And we even made a Bat Doc video together.
We did. It was so much fun.
It was fun. And we were planning to do this paper. And then I run into the senior author of the paper. And I said, hey, Meredith, you want to come on and talk nerdy to me? And you were kind enough to say, yeah.
Of course, definitely.
All right, well, your part now is to give us the author's conclusions.
Okay. The conclusion for our study was that oral prednisolone had a clear benefit over placebo at reducing the length of stay in children presenting to a pediatric emergency department with a virus-associated wheeze and was well tolerated.
All right, Tessa, let's run through the quality checklist for randomized clinical trials. The first question, the patients. Are these ones from the emergency department?
Yes, they were.
Did they adequately randomize them?
They did.
Did they conceal the randomization?
Yes.
Now, did they analyze the groups to which they were randomized?
No, they did a slightly modified intention to treat analysis.
And the study patients, were they recruited consecutively?
It's not clear.
The patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Unsure.
All the participants, were they unaware of their group allocation?
Yes.
All groups were treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes and no. There were 23 patients that were in the placebo group that were actually given prednisolone later based on clinician judgment, but these patients remained in the placebo group for analysis.
Was their follow-up complete?
Yes.
Did they consider all patient-important outcomes?
Yes, the study reports follow-up in the first 7 days and then states that future publications will discuss the longer-term findings.
And the final question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Yes, it was.
All right, let's run through the key results. They screened almost 4,000 children for potential eligibility, and in the end, they got just over 600 children being included in the study. The mean age was 41 months, so that's almost 3.5 years of age, and about 2/3 were male. But what was the primary main outcome?
The main outcome is that the median length of stay was significantly less in the prednisolone group.
All right, and drill down into that primary outcome with that median length of stay.
So the median length of stay in the placebo group was 540 minutes versus the median length of stay in the prednisolone group, which was 370 minutes.
And they also reported the primary outcome with an unadjusted ratio of geometric means for length of blah, 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 blah. All right. Basically, if you got prednisolone, you aren't there as long as you were if you got the placebo. And we're not going to go through all the subgroup analyses because you know what? They're hypothesis generating. But how about the secondary outcomes?
So there was no difference in the secondary outcomes at all.
And I don't want to forget adverse events.
There were no serious adverse events reported.
Tessa, it's time to talk nerdy to me.
I'm not really sure how to respond to that.
We have my second favorite number of questions. That's 10. Two sets of five. We're going to each ask Meredith 5 questions about her study. And I'm certainly odder than you, Tessa. So I'll take the odd numbers, and Tessa, you do the even numbers. So let me start with number 1, and this is about selection bias. There is a possibility of selection bias in this study. If you look at figure 1, there were more patients not included in the study than were included in the study. And most of these declined to participate or were not even approached to participate. You also note in the manuscript the difficulty with recruiting in view of junior doctor changeover, so they may not have been consecutive. Meredith, do you know anything more about these patients who declined to participate or who were not approached to participate? And do you think it's possible it could have had an impact on the results?
Well, obviously, we didn't include every patient who came through the study, as you can see in the figure one. There were about 771 children who were either declined to participate or were not approached or theoretically missed from being offered the opportunity to be part of the study. We did log all those patients, but ethically, once they've not been enrolled, you can't actually follow up all of the same information that you get when you're following up study patients. Some of those children will have received steroids, some of them won't have, some of them will have been admitted, and it is one of the issues that does affect your selection bias. But it's just one of those facts that in a clinical trial you can't actually capture every patient in an emergency department setting.
And it's an ethical limitation of the study process, because you ethically can't go off and pursue those patients who didn't agree to be in the study.
Absolutely. You would be hauled up in front of the ethics committee if you were actually going and collecting all the same information for those patients, because you don't have permission to do that.
And we don't want to see you in trouble.
Number two on baseline demographics. So the baseline demographic factors in each group was incomplete. If you look at table one, you state that there's no clinical difference between the groups, but it doesn't seem to be illustrated in the paper using statistical analysis.
Yes, that was frustrating for us, because we actually had completed the table with statistical analysis, including p-values, which did demonstrate no difference between the groups. But at the behest of the editorial committee or the journal during the review process, they asked us to remove those statistical tests from table one. So it has left us with this uncertainty in the presentation of our data for people who are reading it, such as yourselves.
The third question is about blinding. In the methods section, you said that the placebo was, quote, matched for volume, concentration, color, smell, and taste of the prednisolone. In other words, yuck. Did you actually do a taste test of the two solutions, and could you tell the difference? It would have been easy to ask the parents, hey, which group did they think their child was in? Just a test for blinding.
This was the really fun part of when we were setting up the study. Yes, we did taste test the two different solutions. We have a manufacturing pharmacy here at our hospital, and they really love doing this sort of preparation for studies and get all the nasty tasting solutions out and mix them up. And we tasted both solutions. They were both suitably horrible, really indistinguishable for taste and smell and all the rest of those factors. Asking the parents for this sort of information is a sort of interesting sort of thought. And I guess my concern would be that if you ask the parent to taste it, then they may decide that they knew which group they had been in, and that would potentially unblind the parent from what intervention they'd had, and it could become a confounding factor in the picture.
Question four is about the pulmonary score. You mention in the paper that this score isn't validated in children under 5 years of age, so the results from this should be questioned as to accuracy.
When we designed the study, the ED director at the time had already undertaken an asthma prospective review of all the asthma admissions, and he had instituted the PULMI score as a way of actually grading each child coming in with wheeze to determine whether they required admission and also whether they determined treatment requirements. So it was already well established in the department, and everyone had been trained in how to use it, and it had been incorporated into our wheeze management guidelines. It's an easy score using respiratory rate wheeze and accessory muscle use. But it wasn't our primary outcome, but we recognised that it was really good to have some sort of objective measure of severity at the beginning before we started any therapy. And I guess that helped us. The biostats man likes to talk about that gives us the opportunity to do hypothesis generating insights by having some sort of objective measure. So we decided to continue to use that score, although we recognised that it wasn't a one validated in this particular age group. It was easy to administer and consistently used.
We'll put a copy of the pulmonary score in the show notes for people to review. Question number 5 is again back to taste. Prednisolone tastes awful, and it's associated with vomiting. And we've recently covered a paper comparing dexamethasone to prednisolone for pediatric asthma. That was episode number 194, Highway to the Dexamethasone. Did you consider using dexamethasone for these children with a wheeze?
We didn't in this study, but we have, since the study's been done, we have certainly read that paper, and we think it has potential as an alternative to prednisolone.
Question number 6 is about family history or personal history of atopy. We found it strange that your results showed that these things did not affect outcomes in the study. Do you have any idea why?
We found this a little surprising as well. Certainly the difference between children who had been previously diagnosed with asthma and those who had been diagnosed with asthma showed that when you added in steroids, you did get a shorter length of stay. But we didn't find that with the children who had atopy or family history. That may be just a factor of the numbers of children that actually were put into those groups. We are hoping to drill down into that bit more of that data in our follow-up paper, which is going to look more at longer-term outcomes in the 3 months data. So we may have more information about that as we go along. I think the only other thing to say is viral-associated wheeze is a really interesting condition, and it's very heterogeneic. There's been a recent study by Stevenson where they looked at bronchial aspirates from children with asthma and atopy alone, and those with no atopy who present with viral wheeze. And there's a complete difference in the white cell differentiation in those children from those aspirates. So we're just not dealing with the same disease with every child of wheeze.
Question number 7 is about length of stay, your primary outcome. This was counted as the time from the drug was administered to the time the child could have been discharged. However, the time of day for discharge and delays in families arranging transport prevented the children from being discharged at times. Did this have a real effect on inpatient efficacy? If emergency healthcare is 24/7, 365 and can be accessed at any time, does that mean we should be sending people home at any time?
Well, in ED, we have the capacity to send patients home anytime, obviously through the middle of the night. But most parents who've come in with a child who's wheezing and is going to need ongoing therapy through the night are quite happy to stay at least until dawn and then head home in the daytime and monitor their child's illness until they're less sleepy themselves. So we often send our families home before the morning handover so the families can get home and sort out the other children and school and work and all the rest of it. That's a family-focused sort of outcome. But on the inpatient units, when they go upstairs, they all have to wait for the formal consultant ward round, and then they potentially have to wait for discharge meds, and a whole lot of factors sort of confound the length of stay. So that's why we decided to use a ready for discharge time, because it meant that we could actually look at what was the effect of the medication on the child's condition rather than what are the other administrative burdens that were going on in the inpatient unit.
Question 8 is about being discharged in 4 hours. None of the results were significant in the group of patients who were discharged within 4 hours. So would this be relevant to emergency department flow?
Absolutely. I think essentially it gives us the reassurance that if a child responds really quickly to salbutamol while they're being treated in ED, they can be observed for a short period of time, and then we can send them home with their wheeze plan and their GP follow-up, and we don't need to be keeping them for a longer period of time.
Question 9, and this is my last question. How about changing the outcome? Originally, you had dual primary outcomes, and you know, Meredith,
there can be only one.
I mean, it's a bit of an oxymoron. I mean, dual means two, and primary means one. It's sort of like saying jumbo shrimp, fresh frozen, and conscious sedation. And then you changed your study post hoc from a non-inferiority trial to a superiority trial. Can you explain why the change and why you picked 10% as what you would consider being significantly different?
Okay, so just dealing with the first question about the dual primary outcomes, that again, that just came down to trying to work out what the patient flow was and how it worked in the department and anyone who was being admitted. So essentially, patients who stayed under the ED care and went into the ED short stay unit stayed under the same treating doctors, and it became a little bit difficult to actually differentiate when their care started becoming short stay medicine care and not ED care. So having an ED discharge versus a length of stay in the hospital discharge was confusing. So we determined that the best thing was to actually just do total length of stay within hospital, regardless of whether it was in ED or in the wards. It made it an easy, and it actually conforms to having just one primary outcome. The change of the study from a non-inferiority study was always going to be a bit problematic, and we actually set out to show that placebo was not inferior to prednisolone. And then when we were doing the analysis, we couldn't find evidence to support that hypothesis. Essentially, one group, as we were looking at the data, was obviously inferior to the other. So we then undertook a robust post hoc sensitivity and a subgroup analysis, and that's when we then unblinded the groups to discover that prednisolone was actually superior in that post hoc sensitivity analysis. So that's the rationale behind the change in the plan. Why did we choose 10%? I guess you have to set your non-inferiority margin at the beginning of the study, and we determined that if there was a difference of 10% in length of stay, that from a healthcare setting and from a family point of view, that was a significant amount of time to be saved. So it was really a practical outcome.
I really love talking to one of the authors of the paper because you get such a richer understanding of the paper itself. And going from a dual primary outcomes to one primary outcome, I understand. And then also changing your study post hoc from a non-inferiority trial to a superiority trial because you had originally set it up thinking, at least your hypothesis was, that placebo was not inferior. And in fact, it was the opposite. So actually, that strengthens my belief in the results that you obtained. So I absolutely love talking to one of the authors.
So Meredith, we've arrived at the final question, number 10, which is about harm. We must not just consider efficacy, but also we have to consider adverse events and harms. You reported no serious adverse events were reported during the study or follow-up period. Like most studies, yours wasn't powered for harm. One child from each group was reported as being hyperactive, but this is something we often associate with steroid usage.
Yeah, that was really unexpected to us as well. We thought we would see a lot of children with hyperactivity, but it just wasn't reported when we were doing the follow-ups. But it was even across the group. So maybe it's a reflection of the additives in the solution rather than the steroids itself, but obviously don't have enough to be able to be definitive on that. The only other adverse events were that we had two children who were vomited twice, and in our protocol we withdrew them from the study, and that's why we ended up with a modified intention to treat, because technically once they've been randomised, they should have been continued to be analysed according to intention to treat. There were some parents who didn't complete the course. Most of them was because they said their child was better and they didn't think they needed any more medicine.
Well, those are our nerdy questions. Is there anything else, Meredith, you think the SJAMR should know about your study on prednisolone and wheezy children?
I think this is a tricky area to manage, and I think this study helps to give people some confidence that giving steroids is not the end of the world. It's not a bad thing, but we still, I think, have got a little bit more to go to before we really know what's the best treatment all the time for these wheezy little kids.
All right, Tessa, can you comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SJAMR's conclusions?
Yes, Ken, we think that the author's conclusions of efficacy are stronger than the data supports. While there appears to be a benefit to oral steroids for treating wheeze in children, it's not that clear.
And how about a bottom line then?
In preschool children presenting with wheeze to the emergency department who have tried and failed using salbutamol at home, early use of oral prednisolone should be considered.
And how about our case resolution for that little boy you presented?
Well, in view of Tom's salbutamol use at home, his normal oxygen saturations on arrival, and his pulmonary score of 3, he was given 1 mg/kg of oral prednisolone alongside his salbutamol burst treatment. He was then able to wean his salbutamol and was discharged 8 hours later from the short stay unit.
And how are you going to take this new study and apply it clinically?
Well, I had a chat with Damien Rowland, who put together the post for Don't Forget the Bubbles with me, and I agree with his view that the study isn't really going to change what we currently do. It supports our intuition that we don't really have a good diagnostic system yet for infant and childhood wheeze. But looking at both Panicker and the Foster papers, what they support together is that we have different cohorts of children in that preschool age group. So they might all present with similar symptoms of wheeze, but they actually have very different pathophysiological reasons for their presentations. So we've got a broad spectrum from bronchiolitis to viral wheezers to asthma, and we don't have a precise enough difference between these to be able to define our effective management. But what we will be doing is thinking very carefully about the diagnosis in the patients we see or the patients we review. And we'll be thinking, why should these patients not be given steroids?
All right. So what are you going to say to the parents or caregivers of Tommy?
I think we need to be open and honest with patients when it's an area where the evidence is not clear cut. So I'd say to Tommy's parents that this is a grey area. In patients Tommy's age, we've spent a lot of time debating between ourselves and looking at evidence as to whether steroids will help Tommy, and it's not clear cut for him. And so in a case like this, it's important for us to come to an agreement with the parents as to what the best decision is for Tommy. And there's no right or wrong in here, so it'll be down to my feeling, my intuition, but also the parental preference. We know that some parents will not want to use steroids at all, but some will be happy to try it. So we make a balanced decision together.
I love it. I love it. You just explained evidence-based medicine, because you have the literature and it's guiding you as an expert, and you have your own knowledge and clinical experience. And then you bring the parents into it and say, what do they value and what would they like to see happen? And it's where those three things overlap, and that's where you're going to get the best care.
Exactly.
Well said.
Thank you.
So it's time for the Keener contest, and last week's winner was Dr. Rijsma from the Netherlands, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name. They knew that Dr. Douglas Fren was a urologist, and the Fren, and that's spelled, am I saying that right? Fren, P-R-E-H-N. Do you know how to say that? Fren sign?
It's not Scottish.
So if it's not Scottish, it's crap.
I don't know. Yeah.
And Fren's sign is described as pain relief when lifting the testicle. It was thought to differentiate between epididymitis and testicular torsion. What question do you have for us this week?
So our question this week, Ken, is in wheezy children without signs of infection, what other diagnosis should we be considering in this age group?
Ah, good reminder. Well, if you know the answer, send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool new skeptical prize. Now, there is some other FOMED resources, and of course, there's your excellent blog post from Don't Forget the Bubbles on steroids for preschool wheeze, but there is also some other FOMED resources on wheezing in children. For a conference update, I'm off to Costa Rica soon to see my good FOMED friend, Manrique Yumana, at the Emergency Medicine and Acute Care course. Thank you, Tessa, for coming on the SGEM to add some bubbles to the FOMED goodness and cut that KT window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year.
Thanks for having me, Ken. I have loved it.
Well, as you know, if it's not Scottish, it's crap. So could you give the SGEM tagline in your best Scottish brogue?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
I have to say, I love it.
Awesome.
Thank you, Meredith, for putting up with all our nerdy questions. We appreciate how hard research can be and how difficult it can be to get published.
Thank you so much for letting me come on and talk about the study and explain stuff. It's really amazing to have this opportunity.
Well, I gave Tessa the opportunity to give the SGEM tagline in her best Scottish accent. Can you give the tagline in your best Australian accent?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.
I'm easy. I'm easy like Sunday morning.